All right, here we are back again. We're talking about Russ Payne, and I got Ryan Collins here helping me out. Interview Russ. He is, I just looked at the paper, physical therapist.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You work for Memorial Hermann Sports Medicine.
Right.
Now, I went to the Sports Medicine Symposium of the Americas.
Uh-huh.
You don't work in San Diego, right? Because I remember getting some emails from you about something in San Diego.
He didn't get them from me.
No?
You know, I don't know who it came from, but I lecture probably 15 meetings a year throughout the country.
Maybe that's what it was. You're like, hey, I'm speaking here.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Somebody's using my name.
Yeah. Maybe that's what it is. You just stole it. So, all right. So, again, we're Sports Medicine Broadcast. We're live at the Memorial Hermann Sports Medicine Update. Ryan Collins is going to help me interview Russ Payne. We're going to be talking about some biofeedback units, and Russ has got a secret insider tip he's going to be giving us there. And then we're going to be talking about some return to play. ACL rehab and return, stuff like that. So, Russ, why don't you give us a brief overview of your presentation, and then we'll go from there.
Well, this is a lecture I gave at Combined Sections Meeting of the APTA, which is our big national meeting. And we had a session on football injuries, and then my section was on ACL. So this lecture I gave today was with regard to the science of ACL rehab, and then, you know, the different phases that you go through, and then return to function, and who makes it and who doesn't. You know, why do some athletes just perform really well and others don't? So that's kind of what it was about.
All right. So what was the overall consensus? Why does some return well?
A lot of it has to do with articular cartilage injuries and the status of your joint. So if you have a meniscus injury and an articular cartilage injury, it's going to be a lot tougher for you to make that superhuman effort to get back at 8 months like Adrian Peterson. I did his rehab, and he returned at 8 months. But it's, you know, that timeline wasn't that unusual because a lot of people returned at 8 months. But his level of play was off the charts. He was actually better than he was before he got hurt. You know, so the reason that that happened with his particular case was several factors, but one was the status of his joint. The other is he's, you know, one of the most gifted athletes in the world. Plus, he worked really hard and he'd had previous injuries. And I saw him 5 days a week, and his intensity level was, I had like 10 NFL guys at the same time he was rehabbing. They'd all look at him and shake their head because he was different. And what was different about him was his intensity level. And that's what I think is the intangible of success of ACL rehab. When you have that patient that comes in and tell me what to do, I want to do it, what's next, you know. They have a real drive to get well versus those that are really afraid of what the next step is, and they've maybe never been injured. So I think having a previous injury, you kind of go through the learning curve, and I think those two factors, plus being, you know, a crazy gifted athlete, is it's not really fair to compare everyone to him.
Right. Everyone wants to. Like,
yeah, but I think it's bad and good. It's a good thing is that he actually did something that most people can't do. So it gives people motivation. But in reality, like Dr. Andrews' study I quoted in here, is about 11 months was the average return to NFL football players that he had operated on. You know, so 11 months is probably more realistic for you to get to a really highly competitive level.
So you were talking about the articular cartilage and the meniscus. What was his, just a straight ACL?
Yeah, ACL and a grade 3 MCL. So grade 3 means it's completely torn.
Mm-hmm.
So that had to be reattached. He had to be immobilized because of that. You know, but we were lucky enough to get all of his motion back without another surgery to release the scar. And, you know, he had a lot of drive.
So the articular cartilage is a big factor. So
it is, especially, you know, probably more so in jumping athletes than a football player. A jumping athlete, like a basketball player, it's almost a kiss of death for them to have a big articular cartilage injury. They lose speed, but they lose the ability to jump. You know, also soccer players, that's the number one reason they retire, is, you know, degenerative changes in the knee. So if you have someone that has pristine joint, then you're probably going to have a pretty good outcome with them. Some of this had multiple surgeries. They got patellofemoral wear and tear. They got, you know, a little bit, you know, swelling associated with it. Probably take them a little bit longer.
When you have concomitant chondral lesions at the initial injury, what typically slows down the process for that recovery, and then does it limit them whenever you do the return to play? So, meaning you go through the basic exercises initially, but with that chondral lesion healing at the same time as the ACL, what kind of keeps them held back?
Well, a lot of times it's pain and swelling. You know, a lot of times articular cartilage, you know, even if you don't have evidence of it, but you've got a bony bruise, then they hurt, you know, and they swell. So it limits their ability to return, so which is a good thing probably, you know, because their body is not letting them move forward. But when you have pain or swelling in your knee, you have a 50% inhibition of your quad. So it takes them a little bit longer. So it's just kind of symptomatic. And then, you know, as you know, we just monitor their symptoms, and we push our patients. You know, we're pretty aggressive on our return to play, especially if you're dealing with a multi-million dollar athlete that everybody's trying to get him back. So, you know, the number one rule is to do no harm. But when you're really, really good, you can push right up to that point and never go over it. And a lot of that comes from experience and reading the literature and knowing the healing constraints and spending a lot of time with doctors, which is, I've been lucky my whole career. I've been on the same floor with the orthopedic surgeon. So you learn things that they say that you don't necessarily get out in the field.
When you have a patient who's so driven to get back so soon because that's their livelihood, and you have those histological issues, you have those chondral issues that you have to kind of slow them down, what's your best route to take to keep them motivated, but also to say, you know, pull back on the reins and say, hold on, we just can't quite get there yet?
I do sort of an unloading strengthening program. So I tell them, look, we got to wait for this articular cartilage problem to heal, but we're going to kill you with strengthening. You know, so if you pull out the knee model or you pull a picture up on your phone and you show them what an articular cartilage lesion looks like and educate them about articular cartilage and how it has no blood supply, no nerve supply, and you can't feel it, then they buy into it a little bit more. So I think education is really important. So we do an unloading program. We do a lot of leg press. We do tons of cycling. You know, if they got a tibial femoral joint articular cartilage lesion and the patellofemoral joint's okay, then we'll do high-speed isokinetics, which is no load to the tibiofemoral joint. You know, so we try to encourage them, and a lot of times they get kind of down, but, you know, I've got a guy right now that played for the Texans last year that got cut, and we get to go, he just has had trouble getting his strength cut because he's got a little bit of this problem. But he's staying focused, and, you know, a lot of it just depends on maturity level. But, you know, that's where you come in is moral support a lot of times. And then we'll test the water, and we have Alter-G, you know, treadmills, which are a really awesome product to be able to let them run and decrease the load or water, you know, type of unloading programs and keep them motivated.
All right, anything else on ACL?
Yeah. Let's say you have a patient who's come in, an elite athlete that you're working with, and their strength levels are through the roof. But healing-wise, they can't progress. You either have range of motion precautions restrictions or weight-bearing restrictions. Do you just kind of work on their flexibility and say, all right, let's maintain your strength, or you just go ahead and continue to develop the strength that they need, kind of limited based on their limitations?
That's
kind of
a pretty rare hypothetical.
Because
usually if they have a problem, it's going to limit their strength. But if we have someone that's got 100% quad strength and hamstring strength, this is really unusual for them to, you know, have some pathology. But, I mean, again, we just got to – that's where, you know, it comes into me as a professional to protect them, you know, and we got to sit them down and say, hey, look, you can't do this, you know. You're going to cause a problem, and then we find something to motivate them to keep them going, you know. But that's a tough situation. Sometimes that happens in shoulder patients, you know,
right,
where you've got someone that looks great, you know, or an elbow reconstruction, where they've got full range of motion, the strength looks good, they're ready to start throwing, they want to throw, but we need to wait. So it's a lot of times I'll just educate them.
What about the ones who just aren't progressing like you expected? They had a good history of strength. They're good athletes. They're just not moving along like they should. Do you think it's strictly physical, or how much do you feel like potentially could be that mental aspect of getting back and just being worried, or maybe not even having the drive to get back into it again?
Yeah, I mean, that's the psychological profile is what people are looking at right now. You know, it's just fear factor and avoidance is – is a tough thing. And when, you know, I've been doing this 30 plus years, so I have a little bit of advantage to push people a little bit. And maybe a younger therapist doesn't have as much experience, a little bit worried, but I'll just say, suck it up, push through it. It's going to hurt your feelings, but it's not going to hurt your knee, you know. I think motivation from you and confidence as a therapist can help, but there are some people that just, it doesn't matter what you do, they just don't get their strength back. And that's a tough deal, and I deal with it every day. I had a young lady this morning that she's full weight bearing, but she won't put her foot on the ground, you know. And so we have to, again, I think education really helps a lot. If we can pull out, you know, pictures and we talk about healing, we say, look, you're at 4 months post-op, you're ready to start weight bearing, look at all this data. Because a lot of times they say, I feel like something's going to pop, I think I'm going to break something. But if you explain to them and show them some literature and interpret it for them and let them understand that you're, you know, everything's okay, I think education is a real help on that.
So when you have somebody who's slowly progressing in strength, do you have any devices, objective issues that you can kind of show them, this is your level of strength on your good leg, this is your level of strength on this leg, we need to get these guys built up?
Yeah, we do isometric biodex testing starting at 8 weeks post-op. And so every Tuesday, you've seen that in our clinic, it's really nice to have, and it's depressing sometimes, you know, because someone may look okay, but their biotics test is like 70% deficit sometimes. And I tell them, look, these numbers don't mean anything. This is a baseline for you so that when you come back, because it really takes about 6 weeks to move that needle. Mm-hmm. You know, you can test them in 3 weeks. You're not going to see much change. It takes about 6 weeks to change those deficits. And so you're going to come back in 6 weeks, and this is going to be your report card. And it's I use it as a motivational tool, not to tear them down, you know.
And what if they don't have biodex?
Use a handheld dynamometer like you do. Okay. You got to be pretty strong to do that on some people.
Okay. What about getting objective numbers on their strength? If you have a handheld dynamometer, about biofeedback?
Yeah, biofeedback is good. In fact, you know, we're developing a product right now. The only problem with biofeedback numbers is it's basically an amplifier, and the skin hydration changes, and the age of the electrodes change the numbers too. But I think it's a good thing to look at in microvolts of activity that you can produce. And a lot of my patients love that because they say, hey, look at my numbers, they're a lot better. And hopefully we'll have, you know, we will have that in our new product. So we're developing a product you can use on your smartphone that will have, we've got a little circuit board that'll plug into the headphone jack, and then you just, you know, you'll be able to do everything through your smartphone. You download an app by the electrodes and the little amplifier, and then so we can get more objectivity that way.
Used in schools?
Yeah, I mean, it'll be relatively inexpensive product.
So it'll be similar to the, like, I think it's a Care EMG is what I have right now.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I was talking to Ryan, or we were talking just before we started the interview. I wrote a grant, and Ryan is going to come teach us how to use them. So we got two of those Care EMG biofeedback units so that we can, you know, obviously allow our athletes that have injuries to use them, but also to teach students, you know, which muscles are working or how mm-hmm. to make those muscles work. So that product's essentially going to do the same thing because it has electrodes that you plug in, and the kids have to put it.
Yeah, that's what we use electrode in our clinic right now, too. The Care EMG is probably the best one. The only problem is you can't buy them anymore in the U.S.
Yeah.
You can buy them from the U.K.
What do you typically use the biofeedback for specifically?
I use it for, you know, quad re-education, and I use it for hamstring relaxation. So I'll have patients lay on their stomach with their kneecaps off the edge or having trouble with knee extension. And 99 out of 100 of those have reflex muscle splinting in their hamstring because they've got a co-contraction because they're walking with a bent knee. So we put that over the hamstrings, let them see the light, and we're trying to get that light to go down to zero so they have no muscle activity, and voila, their knee goes straight. So the first 6 weeks post-op, you don't develop a flexion contracture because that's not enough time. You don't have scarring in the posterior capsule. You've got reflex muscle splinting, so that'll help. But I like biofeedback because your patients have to work with that. If you put muscle stim on, and the muscle stim is fine, a lot of people use it. In my hands, and most of the clinicians that, you know, electrical stim, they come into my clinic and work, and they realize that you can't sit there and check your phone and do biofeedback or look at a magazine. You've got to work. You know, and you can change that threshold of sensitivity, so they have to have a certain maximum volitional contraction each time, and it makes a difference.
Do you have a number that you shoot for?
I don't really worry about the numbers, you know, because it changes from day to day. But I adjust it every time they come in. Every time they come in, I like the light to go all the way to the top, you know. And I just push the down button until they, with a maximum contraction, they can keep it loud all the way to the top. And then we do 10 seconds on, 10 seconds off for 10 minutes. So they're doing quad setting for 10 minutes, which is, by the way, the highest EMG for the quad of almost any activity.
So for a trainer like himself with a room full of kids, is there a way that he can teach his students to help the students that come in that are injured kind of learn how to use it? But also, is there a way to kind of get an idea if you're doing well or not? Would you use the uninvolved side as kind of a baseline?
Yeah, you can do that for sure.
Yeah,
I mean, it's definitely – I do that, you know, in the clinic because some people are like, hey, you know, this thing's not working, you know, there must be something wrong with the machine. You can put it on the normal side and boom, the light goes straight up and you can look at the microvolts and oh my gosh, man, what is going on with my knee? And say, ah, don't worry about it, it's perfectly normal. But it gives them an idea of what you're getting at, that, you know, it can be a teaching tool for your patients also.
Any other body parts that you use it on?
I use it every now and then on rotator cuff. Someone that's having trouble firing their posterior cuff, I'll use it. There's a little bit of bleed over there, but it works pretty well for that. And scapula.
Doing like side-lying external rotation?
I do standing external rotation at 45-degree angle because I think that gets you – well, no, it's more of a 45-degree directed force with TheraBand. But I think you can do it side-lying also, yeah.
What about muscular tension, let's say, like, you know, your typical elevated shoulder scapular hikers? Can you see that, like, with your muscular splinting with the hamstrings? Has it ever been utilized for?
I've never done that, but that's a good idea. You know, try that. Yeah.
All right. So, one of the other issues, you know, Bill, my coworker, had trained the kids pretty good to where they would come in and they'd grab it because we had like three girls doing ACL rehab. They'd come in and get their machine and hook it up, but. With those, how much difference does it make if I move it over an inch or in one way or the other?
Electrode placement?
Yeah, if I put the electrode, you know, right here versus, you know, just slightly to the left, slightly to the right.
Well, the hardest one to get back to VMO. VMO just goes away. So I always put it on the VMO first, and then I try to put it over the motor point of the femoral nerve, which is kind of upper mid-thigh, right where the femoral nerve enters the quad. So that gives them the best chance of having the best electrical activity. And then we're trying to... You know, the vastus lateralis contracts pretty readily, and then the VMO is the last one to come back. So we put it over the VMO and then at the motor point. It don't have to be exact.
Are there diagrams that these students can look at to kind of see where an ideal motor point for the
VMO?
I don't
really know the answer to that, but I'm sure they can just Google it and pull it up. Just Google motor point for your femoral nerve or quadriceps, and it'll probably pull an image up right away.
It'll work. Yeah. Yeah, because, like I said, they're new this year. We're going to get Ryan to come show us, and hopefully this helps you teach us.
It's a good educational tool.
Yeah, and, you know, if we're preparing our students to be leaders, hopefully, then, you know, if they know about how to use that stuff, then it's good.
I think we're ahead of the curve on this in the Houston area because there's not a lot of people use biofeedback, and there's not much literature on it. But the reason is because muscle stim is reimbursable. Biofeedback is not. So wherever the money trail is, they fund research. So there's been tons of research funded on muscle stim, but when I lecture, I have at least 10 people come up and say, hey, I've been trying your biofeedback. Where can I get one? And that's why we're developing this product, because it's really hard to find a good one at a reasonable price.
Any ETAs on your product being put out?
We're going to show it at the team concept meeting in December in Vegas, so we'll have it by then for sure.
Is this biofeedback transferable to any other type of pressure pad or force plates that you can activate onto the phone?
I don't know the answer to that. I'm working with the University of Delaware Engineering Department, and one of my partners in this is Brian Pryor, who's the CEO of LightCure Laser. So he's an engineer, and he's a mentor for that department. So they're we've got their students taking this on as a project, and they've been working on it for a year. So we got three electrical engineers, a software guy, and a business plan person. So they're, you know, they spent a year on it. And getting that circuit board right, because the data that comes into this phone has to be cleaned up to a certain level so you can manipulate it. So I'm not sure how it would work with anything else, but it's basically going to be an EMG. So, you know, it could be a high-level EMG that other people might use for diagnostic purposes. But for me, clinically, and there's also, off the subject, there's a huge market for this with women's health and pelvic floor strengthening. Mm-hmm,
because every...
It's bigger than...
The first page of the manual and the biofeedback unit has, say, an insert for rectal and vaginal.
Right, so we're going to make a big impact in that area, too. Yeah.
Gotcha. Anything else, Ryan?
I think we covered our bases.
Any other thoughts, comments? Have you talked to Ryan about the ACL protocol that they're doing, where it's standards based rather than weeks based or whatever?
Not too much. I don't know if we have or not.
The criteria
based protocol. Yeah. I mean, is that what we've been working on for the past year? Yeah. I know all about that.
Yeah.
I thought it might be something new. Yeah. We did that. I was on a consensus panel in 1989, a Biodex consensus panel. We had all the top therapists in the country, and it was evidence-based rehab protocol. And we published that in Orthopedic Journal way back then. So that was a move towards progressing people, you know, based on objective criteria instead of just, you know, time frame.
Yeah, so Russ's group out there, the Med Center, where we're working with Lane Bailey, the Director of Research and Education, they're collecting all this data with their post-op patients. Dr. Lowe has a post-op clinic on Tuesdays, and they basically herd in all these athletes and these individuals who had ACL injuries and knee injuries. And this is where they collect the data.
Yeah.
And Russ has been a part of that. And
gotcha. That's part of my talk that I presented. So we've got almost 250 patients in that group. Who's doctor? And we see about 20 to 25 patients every Tuesday morning. So basically, this is something I've been trying to do for like 20 years for Dr. Lowe. Because Dr. Andrews has been doing it his whole career, and he got it from Jack Houston of the Houston Clinic, who's one of the fathers of sports medicine. And so it's really cool. So that patients don't fall through the cracks, mainly is what it was for. But we kind of took it to a different level. So every Tuesday, if you're 8 weeks post-op or longer, you come in and I have my cheat sheet, and I go through and ask the patient their complaints, what they've been doing, where they go into therapy, what's the therapist's name, their post-op time, and what exercise they're doing, and then upgrade them and ask them questions they want to ask Dr. Lowe. So I get all of that out of them when then he comes through with his fellows and residents, and I can present the case to him, and we're both on the same page. In addition to that, our residents, our orthopedic and sports residents, physical therapy, are taking all this data. They have a subjective questionnaire they answer on the computer. We do range of motion measurements. We do a single leg hop for distance if they can. We do a Y balance test to measure their function there, and then we do an isometric biotics test. So we've got a lot of good data, and we're going to publish that before too long.
And then lucky therapists like myself can get that data sent to me so that I can see what the patient needs to be addressed if their hamstring to quad strength ratio is lagging behind, but their quad's doing well. I can alter my program to emphasize more hamstring strength to kind of catch that up so that the next follow-up kind of meet those expectations that they're looking for with the strength and biodex assessment. So it helps as a therapist to kind of see, you look good doing this lift, you look good doing this lift, but whenever you sit them down and you specify the muscle groups out and you know there's certain standards that mean that they need to meet in order to progress and to be safe when they progress, and that helps me develop a program that's going to best utilize them and get the best outcomes possible. So it's been beneficial for me as a therapist.
It's so good for the patients and their parents too, because they can look good and you think they're doing good. And the other thing is, hopefully we're helping prevent injuries, you know, and not returning them back to sports, because some people can look good but they're really not there yet. And a lot of times, like I said in my lecture, there was a study I quoted that, you know, patients get re-injured more in football and scrimmages than practice. They get more injured in actually really games than they do in scrimmages. So it's hard to reproduce that with a functional test. So we want to do the best job we can by putting them in these positions and having these functional tests to make sure as best we can that they're ready instead of just, hey, you look good, do a leg raise, you know, okay, let me know how it goes.
So, yeah. 24 weeks, you're good to go.
Right.
So you said they get injured more in scrimmages than in games?
No, they get injured more in games, and they get injured more in scrimmages than they do in regular practice.
So it's games, scrimmages, practices from highest to least?
Yeah.
Because I would always think game practice you're going 4 days a week. Game there's one day a week.
Yeah, but the level and intensity is not there. And that's what we're trying to figure out, the ultimate functional test. And a lot of times quad deficit, you don't bring out too much in some of these functional tests because they're all acceleration driven. So when you're sprinting, you're not stopping. And we've kind of missed that, and I figured that out when I was chasing my little boy down the backside of a green on the golf course, and my five-year-old was outrunning me, and I'm going downhill using all quad, and oh, you know what we've been missing? We've been missing deceleration on our functional tests. So we got to come up with some type. We haven't figured it out yet, but one thing I did look at is I videotaped our figure of eight, and I realized that these patients are skipping around the cones. The videotape I showed up there, this one girl doesn't even put her involved foot down. She just touches it and skips around. The other thing is how many steps do they take when they round the cones? Mm-hmm. Usually, you know, for an ACL, it's about three. But someone that's really rehabilitated, they only do one or, you know, two. They plant and they cut around it, you know. So we're evolving, you know, with this problem.
Some good video footage you can see there. So
yeah.
Cool. Good. All right, Russ, thanks for joining us on the Sports Medicine Broadcast, for sharing a little wisdom and giving me and Ryan some ideas about our biofeedback. And we look forward to seeing your product. Hopefully we can get that in the schools and we can get something working there. So if there's any way I can help you out there at a high school, let me know.
Okay, we'll do.
So, all right, for the Sports Medicine Broadcast, that's a wrap.